communism, a whole new world and the emancipation of all humanity, not the last shall be first and the first shall be last. As has been spoken to repeatedly, and I will go into further in this talk, the objective of our revolution, the communist revolution, is the achievement, to put it in a concentrated form, is the achievement of the four alls that Marx spoke of. Speaking of the dictatorship of the proletariat as a necessary transit to those four alls, to the abolition of all class distinctions, of all the production relations on which those class distinctions rest, of all the social relations that correspond to those production relations, and the revolutionizing of all the ideas that correspond to those social relations. This is, one and the same time, a very sweeping and a very concentrated expression of what this revolution aims for and must achieve in order to, in fact, arrive at the new historical epic of communism. And any vision that views what we're all about as something less than that will not only fail to arrive at capitalism, but at communism, it will arrive at capitalism. It will not only fail to arrive at communism, but it precisely will ultimately, and perhaps not so ultimately, lead back to capitalism. The formulation of the four alls is another way of encapsulating and concentrating the other way in which Marx spoke of this, that is, the need to cross entirely beyond the narrow horizon of bourgeois right. And unless and until this revolutionary struggle and the masses of people who are its motive force, in fundamental terms, advance fully and finally beyond the narrow horizon of bourgeois right, they will be forced back under the rule of the bourgeois system and bourgeois dictatorship. And I want to speak to many different dimensions of how that's true and the importance of grasping this deeply and applying it at every stage of the struggle. Even now, before the seizure of power and before there are once again socialist states in the world, and in an even greater dimension, once that first great leap has been made and there are parts of the world which have been wrenched out of the hands of the imperialists and set on the liberating course of advancing toward communism on a whole new level. Lenin said that there are those whose view toward the revolution is, those others, they had their turn, now let me have a go. And he went on to say that for all those who view the revolution in those terms, they are still speaking from the standpoint of the petty bourgeoisie, which seeks to improve its position within the overall system of commodity production and exchange. And furthermore, and even more fundamentally, that this viewpoint serves and fosters ultimately the bourgeoisie, bourgeois relations, and the capitalist imperialist system in today's world in new or even in familiar old forms. They had their turn, let me have a go, in one form or another, we should understand, is the motivation with which broad masses of people will actually enter into and to a significant degree carry out the revolution to overthrow the old order. It will be a mixed bag, to put it that way, of sentiments and motivations among the masses of people, but many of them will be coming from the standpoint that I never had a chance under this system, however they conceive of that. I never had a chance to have a decent life. I never had a chance to advance. What I was able to accomplish in life was not commensurate with what my abilities are. I know I could have done a lot better. I have a lot of potential. A lot of different ways in which you even today hear masses talk about their situation and how they're being held down. And there's a lot of truth to all that. The potential of the masses is suppressed and suffocated in many different ways. But spontaneously, this is overwhelmingly still viewed in individualistic terms, in terms of what's happening to me and what I'm being prevented from doing. And many of the masses, in fact, the great majority of those who will be even the solid backbone of the revolution and the most determined fighters and fierce fighters in the correct sense, when the all-out struggle for power comes on the agenda, will still be largely and essentially motivated by that at that time. This is another one of those acute contradictions that's built into everything that we're about. If we were to say, no, all of you who haven't fully renounced that viewpoint have no place in this revolution, we would A, have no revolution, and B, be a very lonely bunch. On the other hand, if we don't recognize that this is something that's in contradiction in very significant ways to what this revolution is actually all about, then we will also lose the revolution before long as well. And the attitude and sentiments of the masses in this regard will be more contradictory than I'm presenting it here. It will be a mixed bag, as I said, of those kinds of sentiments that I've spoken about, as well as much loftier and broader and more sweeping sentiments of wanting to see the emancipation of all humanity, with a lot of mixed understanding of what that means and what goes into achieving that. But we should understand very clearly that it's one thing if the broad masses of people of different strata, but including among the lower, deeper sections of the proletariat and basic masses, have a mixed bag of those kind of motivations, and within that mixed bag, a big part of it, even the major part of it, amounts to what Lenin characterizes, they had their turn, let me have a go at it myself, even if not in the most narrow and petty and certainly vicious terms. It's one thing to recognize that that will be the case, and at the same time to be acutely aware that this poses a very sharp contradiction that we have to resolve not an overnight, but through the course of carrying forward that whole transit to the achievement of the four alls, as Marx put it. But it's another thing if this attitude and motivation characterizes the leading force, the vanguard of the revolution. That's not to say because things are not pure and absolute in the world. They are, everything is contradiction, and everything is driven forward by contradiction. So that's not to say that within the vanguard and among even the most far-seeing members of the vanguard, there won't be those kinds of motivations that arise and get mixed in. But what the question is, what characterizes what's leading and increasingly setting the terms of this revolution? Is it we've been held down and now it's our chance? Or is it that we want to emancipate all of humanity by abolishing, finally, through a whole process of revolutionary struggle and transformation all over the world, all of those alls that Marx spoke of, all forms of exploitation and oppression, and all of these profound social inequalities, in order to get to a whole new era of human history in which such things no longer exist and effectively can no longer exist, and humanity is struggling among itself and with nature in a whole different way, from a whole different material foundation and with a whole different world outlook and methodology. The latter is what has to be the guiding and leading edge in order for this revolution to go where it has to go, in order for it to deal with all the contradictions it has to deal with, including the contradictions involved in the motivation of most of the masses at the time that the revolution is made. So that's one point that I want to emphasize, because it's extremely important for us to grasp the nature of this contradiction and to understand how to correctly struggle and work our way through it in that sense. It's not that we should accept it when the masses express these sentiments and simply tail them. We should struggle even sharply with them over this and raise their sights and give them a materialist grounding and basis for understanding why they have to make a leap to a whole other way of understanding the world and what needs to happen and how to go about making that happen. But we're going to have to, this is another expression, not in with regard to the petty bourgeoisie only, or even essentially, but it's another expression of having to live with and transform. We're going to have to live with and transform both in the stage leading up to the seizure of power and in a whole other way afterward. We're going to have to live with and transform these kinds of sentiments. Live with them not in the sense of simply accepting them or tailing after them or allowing them to set the terms of things, but living with them in the materialist sense and materialist understanding that they're going to be there. That's going to be part of the objective terrain that we're going to have to deal with, and that such sentiments are going to be not only left over in some general and abstract sense from the old society, but are going to be constantly regenerated and reinforced by the remaining inequalities and social relations that we have not yet fully transformed as we move toward the achievement of the four alls. Now, the next thing I want to speak to in light of this is the Paris Commune and communism. A lot of people, particularly anarchists and people whose all viewpoint is still ultimately within the narrow confines of bourgeois right, but who are radical in their opposition to the system in some ways, and even often expressly opposed to capitalism as they understand that, hold up the Paris Commune as the model of what the new society or an alternative society should be like. And they expressly talk about how there was not a vanguard leadership in the Paris Commune in the same way that there was, for example, in the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia and in the Soviet Union, or in the Chinese Revolution and in the new socialist society it brought into being. I remember at the time when the party's draft program came out a number of years ago, I was listening to a tape that was made of a program on, I think it was KPFA in Berkeley. And a couple of people were on representing the party and talking about the draft program. And it was a good discussion. And after the program ended, or just as it was ending, there was someone else in the studio to work on some other program. And they got very agitated about what was being talked about in terms of dictatorship of the proletariat and the need for a vanguard. And they began interjecting themselves inappropriately into this conversation. And, you know, they weren't invited. They were uninvited guests, as the saying goes. And they began to agitate about how, you know, this is not what we need. We need the Paris Commune. The Paris Commune didn't have this vanguard. And I'm listening to this tape and I'm saying, yes, and that's exactly why it was defeated in 2 months, among other reasons. But that's one of the principal reasons why it was defeated and smashed and drowned in blood so quickly. There were other material factors contributing to that. But the Paris Commune was one of those acutely contradictory things that Marx said about it, that, well, he didn't think it had much chance of success, actually, of lasting very long, but it had to be wholeheartedly supported. That was Marx in his, you know, the best illustration or a very sharp illustration of Marx's grasp of materialist dialectics. He didn't think it could last. It probably would be defeated as it was, but he didn't therefore fold up his arms and say they should not have taken to arms. They should not have risen up, as a lot of the so-called socialists and other similar types did. And Lenin pointed to this later as an extremely positive example of the kind of leadership that Marx provided. He not only supported it, but even knowing it was likely to be defeated while he supported it, he sought to draw every lesson that he could out of it. But the Paris Commune was one of these acutely contradictory things. Marx said that was the dictatorship of the proletariat, and yet it had very few Marxists in it, and was led by a lot of other tendencies and trends contending with Marxism, a very weak element in it, which again is one of the concentrated expressions of why it was so rapidly defeated. So the Paris Commune is not what we should be seeking to repeat. often people have, even, you know, for example, Kavanu, against whom I wrote a whole polemic, retreated into the basic idea as a way station along the way to completely retreating into a bourgeois outlook and bourgeois politics, retreated first into a position opposing the experience of the Paris Commune against the Soviet and Chinese revolutions, and to a large degree precisely over this point of whether or not there needs to be a vanguard, and in fact a vanguard whose leadership is institutionalized in the new society. And a big part of the polemic that I wrote against the Kavanu position at that time was speaking to, from a number of different angles, both with regard to the underlying material factors, the international factors as well, and then the political and ideological superstructural factors that constitute and establish the need for that kind of vanguard leadership, and in fact the need for that to be institutionalized as part of the formal structures of the new social society in the context of a broader constitutional framework. So posing the Paris Commune against the further experience of a dictatorship of the proletariat, and posing the commune as a positive alternative to what is then viewed as a negative experience of the dictatorship of the proletariat, leads backward and away from where we need to go. The commune was a first attempt. There were real material reasons why Marx could see that it wasn't likely to succeed. It seized power in a small part of the country of France, basically in one city. It hadn't even, by the time it was drowned in blood 2 months later, it hadn't even engaged the question of how to deal with the peasantry, which was a very large part of the population of France. And there was the whole international situation. This Paris Commune broke through in the context of a war between the French bourgeoisie and the German bourgeoisie. And even the bourgeois revolution in France, less than 100 years earlier, had encountered the combined opposition, not just politically, but militarily, of a number of powers in Europe, even the bourgeois revolution. So you could imagine, had this proletarian revolution consolidated itself and been able to extend its rule throughout the country, had it been able to begin engaging how to deal with the contradictions that would have arisen if you had to deal with a significant peasant population and other strata of the petty bourgeoisie throughout the country, would then have had to deal with this whole phenomenon of being ganged up on by a number of powerful bourgeois states surrounding it. The Paris Commune never got to the point of being tested, in a certain sense, of engaging and having to deal with all these different contradictions, because it was defeated and drowned in blood within a couple of months. It was only the Soviet Revolution, drawing off the experience of the Paris Commune, but not seeking simply to repeat it, that actually engaged all these different levels of contradictions that I'm talking about in an even fuller dimension. And then again, the Chinese Revolution coming behind it drew from the lessons not only of the Paris Commune, positive and negative, but of the whole Soviet experience. Now, other places I've spoken to this, and I'm not going to try to go into it here, but it's important to have some historical perspective on this, and to understand how, while the commune was in itself and at the time and under those circumstances a tremendous breakthrough, it was a very primitive and very short-lived breakthrough that could not have lasted in the form that it existed. If it had gone on and succeeded, it would have had to change. The form of government would have had to broaden out to encompass more of the population, even while it remained, in essence, the rule of the proletariat. And somehow, a communist vanguard, would have had to been forged in the crucible of that whole situation, which would have been extremely hard to do. Mao, in his typically Maoist way, said, looking at it with historical sweep at this, said about this experience, "I'm afraid if the Paris Commune had lasted, it would have become a bourgeois commune." Now, that's one of those statements by people like Lenin and Mao that concentrate hundreds of pages of thinking into a single sentence. But he was speaking to all the different contradictions it would have had to engage, and to the whole international situation that it emerged within, and the likelihood that had it lasted and still maintained the name commune, it would have nevertheless become a bourgeois republic, would have been dominated by bourgeois forces, and would have in fact been grounded in bourgeois production and social relations, and would have had therefore the corresponding superstructure. So we can say with historical perspective about the commune, the first time was tragedy, but also inspiration. The second time, attempting to do it again, after the experience of the dictatorship of the proletariat and in opposition to the experience historically of the dictatorship of the proletariat, would be disaster and would lead to great disorientation. Simply trying to repeat the experience of the commune, when that experience is shown, and further experience of the socialist revolution has shown the glaring insufficiencies, limitations of that commune, could not even lead to an experience anywhere near as positive as the first commune. And therefore would lead in the attempt to disaster and, yes, to broad disorientation. So when that guy got on that radio show and was railing about how we don't need this, we need the commune, his face was pointing backward, not forward. What we need is a further leap and a further synthesis, drawing from and synthesizing all this experience, the mainly, even overwhelmingly positive experience, but also the negative aspects, and even seriously negative aspects, and even not only significant, but even grievous errors that have been made by the people seeking to lead this process through the historical experience of the proletarian revolution and socialist society up to this point. We need to leap forward, casting aside the negatives that we can recognize and going deeply into this experience in order to identify those negative aspects, bringing forward the positive experiences, but also recasting them in light of what has been learned from both the positive and negative aspects of it. That's what it means to strive for and to take up a new synthesis. And that means putting your face forward to the future, not backward to an illusion, which is what any attempt at recreating or bringing into being again the commune could only be at its best, an illusion, and at worst, a disaster and something leading to wide-scale disorientation. Now, along with this, it's necessary to emphasize that our goal is communism, not communism. We are not seeking to recreate the Paris Commune. The proletariat, to put it another way, wants to go out of existence, not maintain a quote-unquote workers' republic. And in understanding that difference, engaging and wrangling with and coming to a grasp of that difference and seeing what a profound difference it is involves a leap between two very different world outlooks and two very different objectives, two radically different objectives. The proletariat wants to go out of existence. The proletariat wants to abolish what's the first of the four alls, all class distinctions. It wants to abolish the existence of classes altogether. It doesn't want the proletariat to rule forever over everyone else. Because if the proletariat seeks to rule forever over everyone else, it will soon be ruled over again by someone else. Simply seeing only to the horizon of establishing a workers' republic, and I'll get into further how even that conception is too narrow, but seeing only to that horizon and not beyond it will lead, once again, back to not a workers' republic, but at best, a bourgeois republic. In other words, a bourgeois dictatorship. In order to get a deeper understanding of this, let's go once again to the material base of things. There can never be too much materialism in the world. And there's way too little of it right now. So let's once again dig down to the material underpinnings and dynamics of this. As I've spoken to elsewhere and as I touched on in speaking to the four alls here, you notice how Marx, if you want to put it that way, constructed this formulation. He began by saying that the dictatorship of the proletariat is a necessary transit to the abolition of all class distinctions. And then what did he say next? And to the abolition of all the production relations on which those class distinctions rest. Here was the materialism and the dialectics of Marx again. An entirely new understanding in the history of humanity was being applied here. It had been forged by Marx together with Engels, but primarily by Marx. Concentrated in that phrase, within that formulation of the four alls, all the production relations on which those class distinctions rest is a tremendous amount of new understanding at that time in the history of human society. A lot of people, like what did Marx say when he wrote to Wedemeyer? Speaking about what it was that he brought forward that was new, he said, "No credit is due to me for discovering the existence of classes or the anatomy of the classes or even the struggle between the classes. What I did that was new was to show that the existence of classes is only bound up with certain phases in the historical development of production, that the class struggle inevitably leads to the dictatorship of the proletariat, and the dictatorship of the proletariat in turn leads to communism and the abolition of classes." Now, I'm paraphrasing, but that's the essence of it. So, you know, what did Marx do here? What is he getting at with all the production and relations in which these class distinctions rest? He's getting to the material foundation. A lot of people recognize there are classes. You'll even hear, you know, Al Gore gets up in 2000 and makes a speech, and, you know, the commentator is saying, is he promoting class warfare? You know, because he talks a few populist, you know, throws out a few populist phrases. Now, their notion of class warfare or classes is completely unscientific. But a lot of people, in England, you know, it's very common to hear people talk about, you know, class. You know, in the popular culture of the youth and everything, you'll hear them talking about being the working class, you know. This is a very common thing in England. And it goes to what was touched on in another talk I gave, you know, the talk about why we're in the situation we're in today. The whole history of slavery in the U.S. and how that blunted class consciousness as compared to England. You know, you got all the songs, you know, even, you know, working class hero and all that kind of stuff. There's a lot of quote-unquote class consciousness in England in the sense, in the superficial sense, that people are more aware there than they are here that there are different classes, and that if you're in the working class, you're getting fucked, to put it simply. There's more awareness of that. But there's very little, unfortunately, at this time, and this is something that obviously needs to change, there's very little scientific materialist understanding of what's the underpinning of that. What is that all rooted in? What are the dynamics that that's all a part of? Or as Marx put it, what are the production relations on which those class distinctions rest? And Marx, in Capital and other places, spoke to this, that these production relations are fundamentally a question of who owns the means of production and what is the character of the ownership of the means of production. Under slavery, for example, as opposed to capitalism, it's not merely the labor power of the laboring masses, to put it that way, that is owned by the ruling owning class. It is the very people themselves who are owned. The slaves themselves, not simply their ability to work, but the slaves themselves are owned by the owning class, by the slave-owning class, which is the ruling class. In feudal society, the masses of exploited working people are not owned outright as literal or chattel property by the ruling class. Rather, they are themselves often part owners. Often they are allowed to own a piece of land or to rent a piece of land, to own certain means of production, but it is in property relations, which reflect underlying production relations, in which they are dependent upon and produced to a large degree for the larger landowning class. In capitalism, the mass of exploited class, the proletarians, are on the one hand not owned by the owning class. They are even free to walk away and not do any work. You don't want to be involved? You don't have to be involved. You can go steal, go to jail or get killed, or you can starve. You don't have to work if you don't want to work. But if you want to live, and if you don't want to be hounded by the police and taken to jail or killed, if you want to work in a quote-unquote legitimate way, you have to search out a capitalist who owns what you don't own, means of production, factory, land, the raw materials that go into making things, and so on, and who, if they can profitably do so, will employ you and exploit you while employing you to make more wealth for themselves than they started out with. Now, to understand this, in every form of exploitation, whether slavery, feudalism, or capitalism, it is a fact that part of the work that the exploited class does goes to providing for its maintenance and reproduction, and part of it goes to the class that owns the means of production or dominates ownership of them and exploits the laboring people. Even under slavery, it is not literally true scientifically that slavery is entirely unpaid labor. And the slave owners and their apologists were very quick to point this out. They would draw, as I spoke to in another context, they would draw the contrast, as they portrayed it, between paternalistic slavery, where the slave owners took care of the slaves, and capitalism, where the capitalists didn't even do that. They would viciously exploit children and then throw them out on the streets as urchins. You know, the stuff of Dickens novels and so on. And the slave-owning apologists would point out, look, we take care of the slaves. Here they have a place to live. You know, it's secure for a lifetime. You know, they have a roof over their head. They have food. We give them clothing, etc., etc. Well, there is truth to that. Scientifically, there is truth to that. Part of the wealth that the slave produced through working did go back into maintaining the slaves at a minimum condition to be able to keep working as slaves. And a larger part went to the slave owners for the various purposes that the slave owners put it to, whatever they decided to put it to. Personal consumption, but to a large degree investing in new land or investing in things other than land, new manufacturers developing, or whatever they chose to invest it in that was available to them. So part of it went to the exploiting class, but yes, part of it did go back to the maintenance at a bare minimum level of the enslaved, exploited class. And the same is true under feudalism. Under feudalism, the renting or even small owning sharecropper or tenant or serf in classical feudalism would work and produce wealth. Marx pointed out, it's very obvious under feudalism. Under feudalism, it's most obvious. Under capitalism, Marx pointed out, everything appears to be paid. You do a job, you get a wage. It appears to be an equal exchange. Under slavery, everything superficially appears to be unpaid. You're owned by somebody, you work for them, and you don't receive a wage. You do, as I was pointing out, receive the equivalent of a wage. But under feudalism, it's very obvious. Part of the time you work, part of what you produce while you're working, you get to keep, and the rest you give to the landowner. So it's obvious that part of your labor goes into your own needs, and part goes to the class that's exploiting you. This is hidden under slavery in one form and under capitalism in another. as I said, under capitalism, it all appears to be paid, while the large part of it is unpaid labor, labor for which the working class receives nothing in return. Value that it's producing for the capitalist, for which it receives nothing in return, and a part of which it does receive in return. In order to maintain itself at the minimal standard to keep being able to work and to reproduce new generations of people in the same proletarian position. And under slavery, it appears to be all unpaid, but it's not in the ways that I've spoken to. It's partly paid and partly unpaid in effect and in essence. So the essential relation of production is ownership of means of production, and what is the character of that ownership and of those means of production? And what is the character of the relationship of exploitation between the class that dominates and monopolizes the ownership of the means of production and the classes which have little or none of that and are therefore exploited in various ways by the class that does? Under capitalism, the proletariat is, quote, not only does it appear to be getting paid for its labor and for every, you know, for and engaged in a fair exchange of wages for labor, but it also appears to be free. It is not enslaved. It is not owned as chattel, as property. It is not tied, as a peasant or a serf is under feudalism, to a particular piece of land, chained there by debt as well as by custom and also by force when necessary to remain on that land. I mean, you look at the history of, for example, of sharecropping, particularly, there were some whites involved in it, but particularly the exploitation of black people as sharecroppers in the period after the Civil War and the defeat of Reconstruction up until the 1960s, more or less. There's still remnants of this in pockets, but largely it was abolished through the 1960s. But what was going on there? You lived on a piece of land that, even if you owned it, was surrounded by land by a big plantation owner, in effect, and often the land you lived on was owned by the plantation owner. Often the tools and other, you know, whatever plow or mule you used to till the land and whatever was owned by the big plantation owner. The store where you bought whatever you needed in the form of commodities was owned by the plantation owner. And at the end of the year, there would be an accounting. Whatever you would raise at different times or at various periods during the year would be weighed, measured in one form or another, and you would get a certain price for that. And who set the price? Well, the plantation owner. I mean, he had to take into account once again that he couldn't starve you to the point where you couldn't keep working. But the plantation owner would set the price. And also, the plantation owner would keep an account of your debts when you went to his store. So often, by the end of the year, it turned out you owed him money. Even after you weighed up and calculated with whatever cheating there was on his part, to exploit you even further, you ended up in debt further to him. And you couldn't get up and leave and not pay your debts. If you did, the KKK and the sheriffs and everybody else would chase you down and bring you back or throw you into debtor's prison, and they exploit you on a chain gang. I'll have more to say about chain gangs in another context. Chain gangs and Bill Clinton. So that was a form of exploitation that corresponded to a sort of a semi-feudal arrangement or semi-feudal production and social relations. But under capitalism, it's not so. The proletariat is not in that situation. Yes, you get in debt, but you are not tied to the land by this whole system, including the debt, and by the whole production relations. If you don't want to work for a capitalist, you don't have to work for them. They don't own you. They can't force you to work for them. The only thing forcing you is your hungry stomach and your kids who are staring you in the face with their wide eyes. And when they're sick, are crying uncontrollably, and you've got to somehow get to the hospital. So you've got to go get work if you can. That's the compulsion, if you will. That's the whip driving you to work and be exploited by the capitalists. And it's not one capitalist that you're working for who owns you or owns, you know, everything but you, including the land and the tools you use as under feudalism, or owns you outright as under slavery. It's a class of capitalists that exploits you. You don't want to work for this company, you try to work for that company. They're not hiring here, you go over and see if they're hiring there. There's no jobs in this part of the country, you go to that part of the country. There's no jobs in Mexico, you try to cross the border and go to the U.S. There are no jobs in the Philippines, somehow you get over to Saudi Arabia and work in Saudi Arabia or Kuwait. This is the condition of the proletariat. It's a free class in the sense of not being owned right and not tied to a particular piece of land or tied to a particular owner outright. But yes, as those apologists for slavery pointed out very pungently, it has to desperately search even to be exploited in order to live. So that's the essential production relation under capitalism. That ownership of the essential means of production or monopolization of the essential means of production is in the hands of a class which exploits another class, doesn't own them as individuals, doesn't force them to work for any particular unit of capital, but exploits them as a class on the basis of its ownership as a class of the dominant means of production. The means even to produce the material requirements of life. This is what class relations are grounded in under capitalism, and in other systems are grounded in a different set of production relations. But while ownership of the means of production or non-ownership is the essential aspect of the relations of production, it's not the only aspect, not the only one which has to be taken into account. Now, Marx pointed out, and I've emphasized this a number of times because of its great importance, that in carrying out production in any particular form of society, people of necessity enter into certain definite production relations. And I've made this point over and over again because it's so important to grasp and so thoroughly hidden, that there is no such thing as an economy in the abstract. The American economy, the French economy, the Russian economy, the Chinese economy. There's no such thing as those economies in the abstract. They all are a set of definite production relations, which are established not arbitrarily by the will of this or that person, not even of the dominant class within those production relations, the owning class, but are historically evolved. If you look at the history of the U.S., and we don't have time to go into all this, you can see the historical evolution of slavery and capitalism at one and the same time, and then the struggle between them in the Civil War, and the outcome of the Civil War leading to the domination of the capitalist mode of production, of capitalist production relations, but the continuation of other, in a certain sense, pre-capitalist or non-capitalist production relations, which I've been speaking to here, particularly in the South, in the form of semi-feudal exploitation, and eventually the abolition of that in any effective sense, and the thorough domination of capitalism and imperialism in terms of the production relations in the U.S. and in terms of what the U.S. exports in the world. It exports capital and the corresponding relations, although in the world it also, as it did in the southern U.S. for a long time, it incorporates into the overall accumulation of capitalism many forms of exploitation that are non- or pre-capitalist. In broad parts of the third world, you still have semi-feudal forms of exploitation, very similar to the sharecropping that went on in the South for nearly a century after the Civil War. But it's all in the service of and under the domination of the capitalist class rooted in these imperialist countries, above all the U.S., and as part of their overall process of capital accumulation. This has historically evolved, and it evolved not in some smooth, even way through economic development uninterrupted by other events, but through a constant interplay between the base and the superstructure. And what is the Civil War? That's not an economic event. It was rooted in underlying economic factors. The development of the capitalist mode of production increasingly came into conflict, and then full-out antagonism with the slave mode of production. Hence the Civil War at a certain point. They were unable, they kept trying to resolve that non-antagonistically, but eventually they were unable to. That's not to argue that in some metaphysical, religious sense there was some force determining that they were bound to be unable to do it, but they were not able to resolve it non-antagonistically in the final analysis, and so they had the Civil War, which, by the way, took the lives of 600,000 people in a country of a population of about or even less than 30 million at the time. It was not a minor event, a minor skirmish. And it was not a quote-unquote a war between states. It was essentially a war between different modes of production in which the slave system, the slave mode of production, became too much of a fetter on the further development of capitalism that the capitalist class developed representatives such as Lincoln, who partly, you know, were pushed on by events themselves, but nevertheless came to the recognition that they had to fight it full out. Lincoln tried to fight it without freeing the slaves for a while. He made very clear that if he could win the war without freeing the slaves, he would do so, and if he had to free them to win the war, he would do so. And he eventually had to free them in order to win that Civil War. And Marx, by the way, kept writing letters to Lincoln saying, you're fighting this war on a constitutional basis. You need to fight it on a revolutionary basis. Now, he didn't mean that he thought the proletarian revolution was going to be led by Lincoln. What he meant was you need to emancipate the slaves rather than being so preoccupied with whether, you know, what Lincoln's, one of his tactical concerns was that if he freed the slaves, it would be one thing in terms of the effect of that on the slave-owning class. They were already locked in war with him. He was worried about the border states that didn't go with the Confederacy but had some slaves. And if he had freed the slaves there, they might have been driven into the arms of the Confederacy. And Marx was polemicizing with Lincoln, you know, arguing with him, look, you know, instead of fighting it this way, being so worried about what the slave owners in the border states are doing, you should be emancipating the slaves because there's a tremendous reserve there for fighting, which you're not even taking advantage of. You're not unleashing. They're still working on the plantations, providing the material basis for the war fighting of the Confederacy. You could change that overnight, in effect. And finally, Lincoln was driven to do so and issued the Emancipation Proclamation. And then we know there were 200,000 former slaves and some already free black people who fought in the Union Army, who flooded into it, who died in much greater proportions, even while receiving lower wages than the white soldiers. Even there was discrimination. But nonetheless, they flooded in and were a key force in winning the Civil War. But my point here that I want to emphasize is this was not a matter of slow evolution of economic development and peaceful competition between the slave system and the capitalist system. They came into antagonism and they fought it out in the superstructure. This antagonism rooted in the underlying material base, the underlying economic base, the production relations, the mode of production of two conflicting modes of production, found its expression, first of all, in politics, in political wrangling and struggle and contention, and then in all-out warfare. Politics went over to all-out warfare in order to resolve what had become an antagonistic conflict between these two modes of production. You know, Mao, I've quoted this before, says that when tools become frustrated, they speak through people. That's another one of those Mao-esque things. Can be understood in a mechanical sense, but what he's really saying is when the production relations are strained, when the productive forces, rather, are straining against the production relations, and when the mode of production is straining against the superstructure, people will arise in the superstructure to give conscious expression to that. And that's what happened in the Civil War. So when you talk about historically evolved production relations, you're not talking about something which evolved or historically developed production relations. You're not talking about something that smoothly and evenly evolved merely in the economic sphere. There's a constant and often very acute back and forth between the underlying base and the superstructure, in which, in an overall sense, what is going on in the economic base with the mode of production is principal, but at times the superstructure becomes principal. What kind of mode of production was going to dominate in the U.S. economy was determined in the superstructure. through the Civil War. So this is the way to understand what Marx is getting at when he says that whenever people enter into production, they enter into certain definite relations of production. And building on that statement by Marx, Lenin went on to talk about classes and the material underpinning of classes. And Lenin said, what are classes? I think this was in his essay, A Great Beginning. He said, what are classes? Classes are large groups in society that are determined, and he mentioned three factors that they're determined by. One, their relationship to the means of production. This is what I was speaking to earlier. Whether they own means of production or don't own them, or own a little or own, you know, a lot and monopolize ownership of the means of production of society at a given time. First factor, what is their relationship to the means of production? Secondly, he pointed out, class position and the class differentiation in society also involves the position of groups of people in the overall division of labor in society. For example, I've spoken elsewhere, and we'll come back and speak repeatedly because it's so important, to the question of the great divide between intellectual and physical labor. People who carry out intellectual labor generally occupy a very different position in the overall societal division of labor from those who carry out physical labor. And then thirdly, Lenin said, drawing from Marx, classes are also determined by the share in the distribution of social wealth that different groups have corresponding to those first two factors. The share of the distribution of social wealth they have corresponding to, one, their relationship to the means of production, and two, that group's position in the overall division of labor of society. Now, if you understand all this, then you can understand, once again going back to the four alls, why eliminating class distinctions, which is a crucial part of arriving, you know, at the goal of communism, or struggling to advance to the goal of communism, but why that in turn is related to the underlying factor of the production relations. That if you don't thoroughly transform those production relations, you cannot abolish class distinctions and even antagonistic class relations of exploitation and oppression. You have to thoroughly transform the material conditions that give rise to classes as a form in which people enter into the carrying out of production, or else you will have the reassertion of class distinctions. If you don't get to the base of things and change the base of them, then the class distinctions, if you just try to artificially eliminate them by leveling everything down, but you haven't created the material conditions for advancing beyond the existence of classes, they will reassert themselves forcefully in one form or another, and once again, tools will become frustrated, and they will speak through people. People will come forward to articulate a position that this attempt to abolish classes in this way is no good and is leading to disaster. The economy is grinding to a halt. Nobody can eat, and we need to go back to the old way of doing things, and they will get a mass following because there will be truth to what they are saying. People will not be able to eat. There will be the kind of chaos that is bad for people, not good for people. They will not be able, the society, in short, won't be able to function in that way. That's why attempts at just leveling, where they, you know, or things that are basically tantamount, that have approached the, you know, the objective of just flattening everything out, not only fail, but lead to disaster, because you have to go step by step to transform the underlying basis. All of those different aspects of the relations of production that Lenin identified, all three of them. You have to transform the system of ownership. You have to transform the division of labor and overcome the inequalities in that. And you have to transform the system of distribution so you get beyond commodity production and exchange and to the communist principle of from each according to their ability to each according to their needs. And you get beyond money as the concentrated expression of commodity production. Instead, you develop other forms for simple exchange, which don't have within them the cell or the potential to develop exploitative relations. But what makes it even more difficult, as if it weren't difficult enough already, is that you have to, in dialectical relationship with transforming all these different aspects of the production relations, you also have to transform, as Marx spoke to in the Four Alls, the social relations that correspond to these production relations. For example, the division between men and women and the oppression of women in society, which is a pronounced antagonism in fundamental terms in every society that's divided into classes. If you go back into the history of humanity, you know, Engels analyzed this, for example. There's some particulars of what he said that were not factually correct historically, because we keep learning more. But the essence of what he brought forward was correct and essential. You know, when he spoke of the origins of the family, private property, and the state, he showed there how the oppression of women was completely bound up with and went together with the split up of society, as he put it, into antagonistic classes. Now, I don't have time to go into all of that here, but it's a very important thing to grasp and to dig more deeply and to get a deeper understanding of how the emergence of private ownership of property, private ownership of means of production, was completely bound up with and dialectically interconnected with the emergence of oppressive relations enslaving women, half of humanity. So you cannot get beyond the existence of classes unless you completely transform that social relation as well as others. But that's one of the most profound and essential social relations. It has to be thoroughly transformed to completely emancipate women, to abolish all forms of the oppression of women and their expression in the superstructure. Which gets to the other point that Marx made. You don't have to just transform the production relations and the social relations. You have to transform the superstructure. You have to transform the laws, the customs, the habits, the traditions, and the thinking of the people. Whoa, they're not going to try to transform the thinking of the people, are they? Yes, they are. Because the thinking of the people now is a reflection of the underlying production and social relations and is fostered and developed in a way and molded and shaped and conditioned in a way to reinforce those underlying oppressive and exploitative production and social relations. And so not just in some abstract sense, but at every point along the way, there's a dialectical back and forth between all these different aspects of the Four Alls, between the transformation of the production relations, the social relations, and the superstructure, both the politics and the ideology. For example, I spoke about the question of the emancipation of women. If in the superstructure the prevailing idea is that women are supposed to be breeders and rearers of children, how can you thoroughly emancipate women? Even if you went about changing certain economic conditions, how could you thoroughly emancipate women, and how could you even maintain any transformations in the underlying economic or production and then the social relations if you allowed those ideas to go uncontested and, in fact, to prevail? And the bourgeoisie is constantly working on this. You know, through the 60s, all this shit of, you know, white dresses and marriage and all that shit went out the window to a large degree. And look how it's come back with a vengeance, not purely by spontaneity. I mean, it's promoted every turn, not just by bridal shop owners and wedding planners, but by the whole force of the bourgeoisie and its superstructure. I mean, you know, families go into debt in the tens of thousands of dollars to help put on these weddings nowadays. And, you know, it's a whole thing that girls are encouraged from the time they're very young to start planning their weddings and play-acting their weddings and play-acting what it will mean to be a mother and so on. He's not going to attack motherhood, is he? Yes, he is. But certainly in the traditional bourgeois sense. But this is a battle that has to be fought out in the superstructure, even though the ultimate purpose is to transform not just the superstructure, but to transform the entire society, all the production relations and social relations and all the political institutions that are the foundation for and in turn reinforce all this. So when you look at it that way, you can see how a notion of just getting revenge, or they had their turn, now it's our turn, or we've suffered enough, now fuck it, let them suffer for a while, or we've suffered enough and I don't give a fuck what happens to them, is going to come nowhere near being able to lead to the emancipation of the masses of people and all of humanity, and in fact will lead away from and back away from it and back to the old society. It's not simply a moral question, although it does have a moral dimension of what's a better viewpoint and which is more narrow and which is more broad and sweeping. It's which is more materialist, which is more grounded in reality and in the actual underlying dynamics and the relationship between that and its superstructural expressions, and which will actually get us where we need to go and therefore should want to go. If you want to abolish all these conditions of exploitation and oppression that people are assaulted with every day in their lives, you have to, in order to lead the process, you have to come to a grasp of the whole scope of what this is all about and all the interpenetration, interconnection, and interplay between the different elements of it all along the way. Shangxun Xia wrote a pamphlet in China, all exercising all-around dictatorship over the bourgeoisie, right in the heat of the struggle with Deng Xiaoping shortly before Mao died. And in there, he pointed out some of the complexities of what they were facing in China, coming from the very backward economic conditions that had been maintained under the domination of imperialism and feudalism in China, only, up until the revolution itself. And they were only a couple of decades away from that. And he said, look, even in looking at these three parts of the relations of production, we've only made certain progress even in transforming the ownership system. Our ownership system is not even completely social. Even in the sphere of industry, we still have certain commodity relations. There are still loans from government banks to certain industries in order to finance industrial development. There are still commodity relations between industry and agriculture when agricultural units sell their products to the state. There are still some commodity relations involved. In agriculture, it's even less developed, the social ownership system. We don't have ownership by the state, even, let alone, the communist ownership by all the people without the existence of a state. We don't even have the preliminary step thoroughly achieved of ownership by the state. Instead, we have ownership by small groups, relatively small groups of peasants in communes and in villages and in production brigades in the countryside and where the vast majority of people live. And he pointed out that while there was some forms of ownership on the commune level involving, tens of thousands of peasants, and there were public works projects where people were mobilized on a commune-wide basis to build roads or other similar things, that most of the actual distribution that went on a very small scale, that basically the work points, that peasants got work points for the amount of work they put in, and they got paid in relation to the work points, and those were calculated at the level of a production brigade, which was a very small unit still. So he was saying, even on the level of ownership, we were a long way from having completed the socialist transformation, let alone getting to communism. And in the other two aspects of the relations of production, the division of labor in society and distribution, we're even farther away from that goal still. So this gives you a sense, the social division of labor still had many inequalities in it. The division between mental and manual labor was still very pronounced. The distribution of income, he said, was mainly still determined by bourgeois right. The main way in which people were paid was from each according to their work. In other words, you got paid according to the kind and the amount of work you did. There was still a wages system. They were working to overcome the inequalities, but they were a long way from having overcome that, let alone abolishing the wage system. Well, you can see, my point here is not to go into the whole history of all this right and for its own sake, so much as to emphasize the complexity once again of what we have to deal with and why you have to have a scientific approach to this that's radically different from and way beyond the notion of Some people are rich and some people are poor. Let's hit the rich people over the head and give the poor people a chance. That's the sentiment in which a lot of people are going to make revolution, as I started off saying, but it's not a sentiment that can guide and lead the revolution where it needs to go and can get rid of the division in the world, not just in one country, but in the world, the profound divisions between rich and poor and all the things that means. You know, I was really struck in reading this article recently in the paper by Leo Nesto about the film about the model works in China. And in particular, I was really glad to see it really picked up on this quote by this asshole. You know, the smug asshole with, once again, the typical Mark Twain combination of, you know, peculiarly American combination of ignorance and arrogance, where he talked about all this stultified and, you know, themes of these models is so, you know, insufferable. You know, these landlords who, you know, have to be punished because they charge too much rent and too much interest. You know, and you can imagine, you know, this guy, you know, not to put down, believe me, everybody in this position, but living on the, you know, the Upper East Side of New York, you know, in a million-dollar flat or whatever, and thinking, you know, about his landlord who maybe is charging him a little too much rent, you know, and he's going to haggle with the landlord about can he get a little bit lower rent. And then superimposing that on the reality of people for whom, as the article pointed out, interest rates and rent meant that you had to, you starved as a result. You sold your children as a result. Your girl children were sold into prostitution or suffocated at birth as a result of these interest and rent. And the exorbitant prices and you know, the gouging of the people. This is not a matter of, you know, whether you could take another trip to the Caribbean this year because your rent was too high. And even people in that strata, we have to win over many of them, but we certainly have to take on that worldview. It really is the gross ignorance combined with astounding arrogance. Well, next I want to go on and talk about what I call reification and positivism, economism and syndicalism, vulgar materialism instead of dialectical materialism. Now, by reification, I mean essentially equating the proletariat and its outlook and interests with individual proletarians, rather than with the proletariat as a class in the broadest sense, and its historical role to which I've been speaking, achieving the four alls. This, in other words, this kind of reification is the opposite of the godlike position of the proletariat to which I've spoken. It's the opposite of sitting on the mountaintop watching the procession of humanity, as I spoke to in that discussion on epistemology, and from that standpoint, seeing the role of the proletariat as the force that can bring about the abolition of all class distinctions and all the four alls, and bring about thereby the emancipation of all humanity from systems of antagonistic social and class relations. And this kind of reification came up in the history of our own party at the time when we had the struggle over what stand to take after there was the revisionist coup in China back in the late 70s. There was a very serious split in the leadership and through the ranks of the party, as I spoke to in the memoir. And it had to do with the whole question of whether we were going to be internationalists or narrow economists and, as we call them, Mensheviks, people who, you know, are basically reformists, but in the particular form of reifying the proletariat, of being very workerist. And one of the sharp illustrations of this is when we had a meeting after the Central Committee meeting that resolved this issue, in which we, you know, took a position of firmly opposing the coup in China, began to take on some of these other associated economist tendencies in the party. I went to a meeting with some other people, leading people in the party, to consolidate or to attempt to consolidate this position in a section of the party which had been dominated by these Mensheviks. And there was a lot of tactical maneuvering, even, you know, that I won't get into. But we finally managed to have the meeting. Even where we were going to have the meeting became a point of struggle. And we finally had it in the house of one of these Mensheviks because we figured that they wouldn't probably start a fight in their own house because we didn't want the meeting to devolve into a fight because, you know, then the police would come and all kinds of other things would happen. And as the meeting unfolded, at one point one of these Mensheviks got up and very angrily declaimed, "This is a workers' party." And we calmly replied, "No, this is a communist party." And in those two positions is a profound difference is concentrated. It's the difference between the reification of the proletariat and the proletariat as a class, as the force which can lead to the achievement of these four alls. And this phenomenon of reification doesn't come up only in that most crude form which I recounted, but comes up in many different forms. Are we going to tail the masses, or this particular mass, quote unquote, because they come from among the oppressed, or they come from the proletariat? You know, are we going to have an orientation of, yes, learning from them, but also struggling? Because we have to, this is about achieving the four alls and about the proletariat's role as a class in relation to that. It's about abolishing all oppression, not worshiping the oppressed in some upside-down notion of unequal relations. This will constantly reassert itself. You know, identity politics is another form of reification, not so much of the proletariat, but of different oppressed groups or marginalized groups. And it doesn't lead anywhere near where we need to go. So are we going to be on the mountaintop? Are we going to be striving for the emancipation of all humanity? Or in one form or another, is it me and my group? And we've been put down, marginalized, and shoved to the side, and lorded over by others, and now it's our chance to put an end to that and do the same to others, or fuck everybody else anyway. Is it reification or emancipation? That's the question. That's the profound difference in world outlook. And this will be a constant struggle, not only in the broader society, but within the ranks of the communists. What are we aiming for? Where are we standing? What is our vista? What is our view? And when we get down on the ground to wage the class struggle and the all-around struggle to achieve those four alls, first by making the first great leap and overthrowing this oppressive system and establishing a new liberating form of society, where are we looking from and where are we looking to as we're doing that? What's leading and guiding and setting the terms in that? When we're down on the ground like that, are we also at the same time up on the mountain with the broadest view and seeing how all these contradictions have to be struggled through and resolved in the service of getting to a whole new era in human history? Is it reification and identity politics? Or is it really the emancipating role of the proletariat in achieving the four alls and bringing in the communist era into being in the world as a whole? Now, in terms of positivism and reductionism, in basic terms, I'm referring to a mode of thinking akin to pragmatism and what we might call immanentism, a form of reducing things to immediate or imminent causes or chains of causal sequences, which is, in a sense, flat and linear, and in effect leaves out the whole dimension of qualitative leaps from one form of matter in motion to another, and of abstraction leaves out the whole phenomenon of abstraction from particular phenomena or from particular concatenations or chains of phenomena, links of phenomena, the leap from that to the larger connections beyond the more immediate physical environment, more immediate set of conditions, or more immediate experience. Or by this I mean the reducing of things to a series or chain of even physical causes. And I'll explain a little bit more of this as I go along. But very relevant here is the profound difference between the fundamental materialist understanding that everything consists of matter in motion, and that in particular human thought or consciousness consists of matter in motion. That real and scientific understanding, which is profoundly important. But the difference between that on the one hand and on the other hand, the attempt to take thoughts or qualities which actually result from a complex interaction of factors, both physical and social, and reduce them to particular physical and chemical processes, reactions, etc., or even to particular genes or particular chromosomes. For example, the notion that there is a gene or genetic selection for selfishness, or conversely, there's a gene or genetic selection for unselfishness and altruistic, other-oriented behavior. These kinds of positivist views and approaches are in opposition to dialectical materialism, which recognizes that all reality, in fact, does consist of matter in motion, and that material factors and processes are what constitute everything, including thinking and consciousness, but at the same time recognizes that consciousness and thinking involves leaps from one state or quality to another, and involves the interaction of a number of different elements or processes, not merely physical in the more narrow sense, but also social, and that this involves syntheses, which are not reducible to the component physical, chemical, electrical, or genetic elements that go into consciousness and thinking. To give an example, if I think about justice, or exploitation, or love, or music, this involves and even consists of such elements and processes. It consists of matter and motion. But it is more than a mere quantitative addition or simultaneous combination of these elements and processes. There are leaps and syntheses involved. Positivism is characterized by, among other things, the notion then of a linear, straight-line connection, a more or less direct extension between experience and concepts. Instead of what actually happens in reality, whereas Mao pointed out, in actual reality, there are repeatedly qualitative leaps from perceptual knowledge and experience, leading to perceptual knowledge on the one hand, which includes, by the way, indirect experience, the experience of others and what lessons they draw from that experience, which I in turn, or you, or others learn about. It's the leap, there's a leap involved from all that to conceptual or rational knowledge, which is qualitatively different than perceptions. It is the putting together, the identifying of patterns, and the putting together an understanding, a synthesis that encompasses those patterns in reality. I gave the example, for example, in the article on two radically different kinds of leaps of the process that's supposed to go on, at least, with a jury. You know, I contrasted two different kind of leaps that could be made by members of a jury. You listen to the evidence. In a certain context, that's perceptual knowledge. Testimony is given, facts are introduced. But what do you do with that evidence and those facts? You have to make a leap. You have to synthesize them in order to draw conclusions from them. They don't contain the conclusions that are necessary within them. Someone says, I saw that person a block away from where the crime was committed 1 minute before it was committed. Someone else says, I saw them across town at the very time that the crime was committed. Well, then you have to weigh other factors and determine whom do you think is more, you know, who is more believable. And you determine that by taking other perceptual knowledge that's relevant and then making a leap to putting it together and seeing what you can synthesize out of that. What are the patterns involved? What's the essence? What are the essential things about all these different facts and evidence that you're being that is being introduced? And if you're proceeding according to rational thought and logic, you make a leap then to put that together. As I point out, if you have 10 people say, well, I saw the person way across town at the time the crime was committed, and no one can introduce any evidence that shows that they have some prejudice or some inclination in favor of the defendant, and then somebody shows that the person who said they saw them right near the scene of the crime has hated this person for 12 years, then rational thinking and logic would dictate that you would have to conclude that there is more than a reasonable doubt as to whether this person committed could have committed this crime. And then I contrasted that with the notion of a leap of faith, whereby someone sits on the jury and says, I know that boy is guilty. I don't like the way he looks. The Lord told me that boy had to be guilty. Well, those are two different kinds of leaps. But in the correct kind of leap, if you will, there's something different going on than merely a chain of evidence being presented with no qualitative leap. The evidence doesn't contain the conclusions in itself as itself. There's a leap required, and this is what positivism in many forms doesn't grasp. And that's true not only in terms of thinking about justice or, you know, deliberating a case as part of a jury, but in all the things that you think about. As I said, physics or love or music or whatever. You are constantly making leaps in your thinking. There's a constant back and forth between the leaps you make and then your further perception of reality on the basis of those leaps. So it's all matter in motion, but it's not all a flat line, if you will. Just a chain of one thing automatically leads to another, leads to another, leads to another, without ever any leaps, without ever any qualitative changes. So again, positivism is characterized by, among other things, the notion of a linear connection, a more or less direct extension between experience and concepts, instead of what actually happens in reality, where, as Mao pointed out, there are repeatedly qualitative leaps from perceptual knowledge and experience to conceptual or rational knowledge. And as applied to society and history, positivism and related reductionism, that is, reducing things down to the level of a linear concept of cause. There's a gene for this, there's a gene for that, there's a chemical process that caused you to fall in love, rather than a complex of factors all interacting. That kind of reductionism and positivism, as applied to society and history, often take the form of economic determinism, reducing everything, including politics and ideology, to more or less direct extensions of economic factors, and those narrowly conceived. Now, this would be a crude rendering, for example, of the statement I've cited a couple of times from Mao, that when tools become frustrated, they speak through people. This would almost render it literally that the tools actually dictate to the people what to say. Or that merely, to put it in other terms, merely by handling the tool, the person would know what to say. Instead of what actually happens is a complex interplay of material factors and social relations and ideas in which ultimately you can find the grounding in the underlying production relations and social relations, ultimately and in an overall sense. So this kind of reductionism and positivism involves a negation of the role and the relative autonomy of an initiative in the superstructure. What I mean by that is, going back to the example of the Civil War. The Civil War did not happen as soon as in the economic sphere slavery and capitalism were posed in antagonistic conflict. It was a much more complex process that went through a lot of different phases before it erupted into all-out war. And political spokespeople, mainly spokesmen, articulated positions on various sides and struggled in the realm of politics, in the realm of government, and develop philosophical rationalizations and apologies for the one side and the other, and battle it out in the realm of ideas. And finally, through a combination of factors, it was not somehow bound in some religious sense to lead to warfare, but it did erupt finally in warfare. This is the complex way in which, quote-unquote, tools speak through people. This is what I mean by the relative autonomy of the superstructure and the initiative that people take in the superstructure. Politics is articulated and carried out, and warfare is carried out by people who have thinking and wills. Ultimately, their thinking and wills are shaped primarily by the underlying material factors to which I've spoken, and in a most concentrated and fundamental way, the production relations. But that's a very complex process. And often what people are articulating cannot in any simple way be reduced back down to the economic relations that they are ultimately defending and speaking on behalf of. People speak on behalf of tools in a very, often a very indirect and complex way and through very complex processes. So this kind of reductionism and positivism involves a negation of the role and the relative autonomy in and initiative in the superstructure. And a negation of the fact that while in a fundamental and ultimate sense the superstructure is an extension and reflection of the underlying economic relations and social relations, this is, to put it this way, mediated through and maybe modified by a lot of factors, including not only social relations and politics, but also culture, ideology, and, as I've spoken to, individual consciousness and wills. Bourgeois politicians, no less than anybody else, and hopefully more than proletarian politicians, make all kinds of stupid decisions and blunders, as well as wise ones from the point of view of their class. And this affects, in major ways, the outcome of struggles, which may determine significant and even qualitative things about the character of the underlying economic base. It's not a mechanical relationship and a one-to-one relationship that's involved in it, but a very complex dialectical relationship. And these kinds of mechanical materialist views that I've been speaking to tend very strongly in the direction of determinism generally, of not seeing the possibility of factors that may lead to ruptures with the existing framework, including factors which may lie outside of the most reductionist view of cause as a chain of directly related elements. And once again, here we get back to the question of the relation between necessity and accident and causality and contingency. For example, let's go back once again to the what happened around Hurricane Katrina. There were all these underlying production and social relations that, viewed in one sense, were kind of lying there dormant. They were actually shaping things on a daily basis, but they weren't exposed in raw terms for the whole world. And then along came something which, from the point of view of looking within a certain framework, was an accident. Within the framework of daily life and the daily functioning of society, even with all of its complexity, this hurricane came in from the outside, so to speak, and in that sense was an accident. But on another level, of course, it wasn't an accident in the sense that it happened for no reason. There were causes, but those causes were unrelated to the daily functioning of life in New Orleans and the society of the U.S. Not completely unrelated, but in a separate sphere. And a determinist kind of view wouldn't see how something like that could have profound repercussions in bringing to light sharply and accentuating the social antagonisms that were at the foundation and are at the foundation of society. So with that kind of determinist approach, you never could actually even recognize, let alone seize on, an opening for a major advance politically, let alone for a whole revolutionary leap to the seizure of power. And all this relates very closely to Lenin's observation that one of the main expressions of revisionism is as follows. What is desirable is what is possible, and what is possible is what is already being done. And this is the way a lot of people spontaneously see the world and see politics. The limits of the possible define what is desirable. Anything else is utopianism and leads to horrors. And what is possible is defined what's already being done. There's no transformation of the objective conditions. There's no rupturing of the limits. There's no transformation of necessity into freedom, which, yes, leads to the emergence of new necessity. But there's merely being confined within the existing necessity. And obviously, this can never lead to radical leaps and ruptures and to revolutionary transformation. So all this is directly and fundamentally opposed to the whole Leninist understanding of and emphasis on the crucial and decisive role of consciousness in the revolutionary process, and a correct understanding out of what consciousness arises, on the other hand, the relative autonomy of consciousness and will, and how in turn that reacts back upon the things which gave rise to it in a fundamental sense, namely the underlying production and social relations. The reason that so many people so bitterly hate what is to be done is because it is a whole rupture with determinism. It is a whole rupture with the notion that all you can do is accept what exists, and that you must define the desirable by what is possible and define what is possible by the limits that are already set at any given time. And the reason I say a lot of people deeply detest this, I don't want to distort this, but there are many people who deeply detest it. And the reason, and one of the essential reasons they do, is because if you have accepted that kind of an approach of defining the desirable by what's possible and defining the possible by what the present limits are, and you are convinced that that this is the way you have to approach reality, then this Leninist thing seems completely out of whack with reality. And more than that, it seems to be the attempt of some strong-willed individual or group of people to impose their will not only on reality in general, but on other people like me, rather than recognizing that it's a dialectical materialist approach to understanding and therefore transforming reality. It's not that Lenin or Marxism in general says that consciousness can transform material reality by itself, or merely by willing such transformation. But rather, it recognizes the dialectical relationship between matter in general and consciousness as a particular form of matter in motion. Consciousness is matter in motion in the way I've spoken of that, and not in some reductionist, positivist sense. But it is, especially human consciousness, as I pointed out before, a particular form of matter in motion. It is a human consciousness as a form of matter in motion which is capable of grasping, engaging, and coming to understand crucial aspects of the material reality of which it is a part, and thereby of transforming now one, now another aspect of that material reality in accordance with the contradictions which are defining and driving it, and to make leaps and ruptures from the particular form of matter and motion in which you're confronted at a given time to another form of matter and motion, to a whole different qualitative state, whether in nature or in society. Now, a scientific materialist and dialectical understanding doesn't lead you to think that you can change of necessity material reality any old way you like. It leads you to understand that you can transform it in accordance with the actual motion and development of that material reality as driven forward by its defining contradictions, but also that you can, on that basis, make leaps and ruptures to something else. And that matter is always tending in certain directions, always moving and changing, and always these different forms of matter motion are always interacting with each other. And this is the complexity of doing anything in life, including, and in a concentrated way, making and leading a revolution, that you have to be able to grasp all these different interconnections, as well as the tendency of the motion and development of particular forms of matter and motion, and know how to lead them where they can go. And first of all, to recognize that we've reached the stage, not through some religious process, but through the working out of all these contradictions, including causality and contingency, or necessity and accident, we've reached the stage where we are on the threshold and can, not automatically or inevitably will, but can make the leap to communism on the basis of the very motion and development of these different forms of matter and motion and their interconnection. And the way that takes shape in particular in terms of the underlying economic base and its motion and development in dialectical relation with the superstructure and its motion and development in the society and world in which we now live. That's the basis for understanding why it's possible, and also, in order, from the standpoint of emancipating humanity, why it's necessary to make this leap. And it's also the basis for understanding how you can react back upon these different forms of matter and motion in a conscious way in order to achieve that kind of change. Not through the imposition of will, in opposition to reality, and in opposition to those people who are trying to live in accordance with reality, but through the dialectical materialist process to which I've been speaking, with all of its complexity. And in opposition to that, and to the whole what is to be doneist approach of Lenin, and the whole recognition on the part of, you know, of Marxism, that as Mao formulated it, matter and consciousness are constantly transformed into each other. That matter that's not conscious gives rise to consciousness among people who have the capacity to think consciously. You have to have a certain form of matter and motion to think consciously. Despite what some people may think, rocks are not capable of conscious thought. They are a particular form of matter and motion that doesn't have within it the capability to develop conscious thought. But human beings, although sometimes they may act like rocks, do have the potential and the ability to think consciously and thereby to react back upon the rest of matter that is influencing the development of their consciousness. And it's not a one-to-one reductionist positive sense of, you know, you see something and it dictates a certain thought to you. It's a much more, as I've been speaking to, a much more complex process involving qualitative leaps and syntheses. But this kind of reductionism and positivism, all these ways of thinking are expressions of vulgar as opposed to dialectical materialism. Recently I wrote an article which was sort of an addendum to the short pamphlet on the U.S. Constitution Exploiter's Vision of Freedom. It was an article that appeared in a paper which was partly an addendum and contained a correction to the what was in the original pamphlet, particularly with regard to Montesquieu's views on slavery. And one of the things that I learned more deeply in going back and reading more Montesquieu and preparing to write that and also, you know, in writing it, putting it together, making leaps and syntheses, was I got a fuller view of the kind of crude mechanical materialism that characterized Montesquieu's thinking, that, you know, certain climates produce certain kind of mentality among people. Well, you know, it's not that there's absolutely nothing to this. I mean, you know, you live in, Las Vegas or Phoenix, Arizona. It has a certain effect on your mood, shall we say. You know, and you try to go out in the middle of the day and do things that you might want to do in San Francisco or, you know, other places, you can't do them. And, if, you know, and besides the hurricane, forget about New Orleans, you know, in the summer. You know, you try to go out, your mood is going to be vastly affected if you try to go out. And because there they not only got the heat, they got the humidity. But those things are not determining of people's consciousness. People in New Orleans do not have a different social consciousness because of the climate there as opposed to people who live in Vermont, shall we say. That is much more determined by a complex of factors to which I've been speaking, the interplay between the economic base and the superstructure, and the basic mode of production and the corresponding character of society is much more determining and influencing of people's outlook, although there, again, not in a reductionist and mechanical materialist sense. So that kind of thinking of Montesquieu, identifying certain, you know, certain kind of climates produce a certain sort of slothful mentality, which means people have to be enslaved in order to get them to do useful and productive work. It's extremely crude and vulgar mechanical materialism. So was the theory of the productive forces, which has existed and exerted a strong influence in the history of the communist movement and of socialist countries. The notion that there's a more or less a direct equation between developing the productive forces, by which is meant essentially technology, and how far along you are on the road to communism, how far you are advancing in building socialism. This was very pronounced increasingly in the Soviet Union under Stalin. There was even some of that in Lenin, as I pointed out in Conquer the World, but it became it took hold on a whole other level increasingly under Stalin, where industrialization and the development of technology was identified with the development of the productive forces overall, leaving out to a significant degree the conscious initiative of people as the most significant and dynamic productive force, and reducing things to mechanical materialist terms in significant measure, so that socialism increasingly began to be identified with industrialization, which is why a certain triumphalism set in the Soviet Union in the 30s, because they were leaping ahead with industrialization, and that was more or less directly identified with building socialism, rather than the essential thing being transforming the production relations in order to unleash and revolutionize the productive forces, most essentially people and their conscious dynamic role. Or we have within the history of the communist movement mechanical materialist notions of crisis and the more or less linear straight line down descent of capitalism toward its doom, particularly once it reached the stage of imperialism. Now, I'm oversimplifying, but there have definitely been tendencies in that direction. There's been the related tendency in the history of the international communist movement to equate class consciousness, and this has to do also with reification, with and to reduce it to the degree to which workers are involved in modern large-scale industry. To make, in other words, a direct and straight line or linear connection between the size of enterprises in which workers are employed and the class consciousness of those workers. So once more, it is important to return to and emphasize the basic point that all of these determinist views are linked to an economist approach and viewpoint. Economists, both in the sense of tending to economic determinism, as I've spoken to it, and in the sense of reducing the concerns and the struggle of the working class or the proletariat to the economic sphere, and in its most vulgar expression, to simply the battle over what price the working class will receive for the sale of its labor power in the form of wages, benefits, and so on, which, of course, is fundamentally reformist, fundamentally and essentially remains well within the narrow confines of bourgeois right, and in fact is in fundamental opposition to Marx, even when it's raised by so-called Marxists. Because it was Marx who, after all, insisted that the watchword or the slogan of the worker struggle should be not a fair day's wage for a fair day's work, equal exchange of commodities which embodies exploitation, but instead of that, abolition of the wages system. In other words, the ending of exploitation and enslavement, in effect, in the form of the sale of labor power in exchange for a wage, and then the use of that labor power by the capitalist in an increasingly intensive and extensive mode of exploitation in order to accumulate for the capitalist more and more surplus value, more and more value beyond merely what is necessary for the maintenance of the working class in its condition of exploitation. What is necessary for the maintenance of the working class in its condition of exploitation is more or less what is embodied in the wages of the working class. So when you demand a fair day's wage for a fair day's work, you're merely demanding to be given what you're due in your condition of exploitation. Whereas to demand the abolition of the wages system is to demand the abolition of that system and those relations of exploitation. And as Marx more fully explained, it is bound completely up with achieving the four alls. Also expressions of the same fundamental philosophical outlook and the same tendency to economism are related viewpoints of anarchism and particular anarcho-syndicalism. Sometimes this anarchism and anarcho-syndicalism takes a more radical, or at least radical-seeming and sounding form. But even when that is the case, it not only remains within the confines of economism, but in general and fundamentally, it gives expression to the viewpoint and the spontaneously conceived interests of strata that are not so much representative of the proletariat as they are, broadly speaking, representative of the petty bourgeoisie, including in this workers in skilled crafts and artisans. One of the common political expressions of this is the demand for control of production by those directly involved in that production, with each group then running its particular site of production as an autonomous unit in what is supposedly an overall cooperative framework. This then as the basis and model for a new society, in opposition, usually explicitly, to the establishment of a proletarian state and its central role in society, politically but also economically. In a series of articles on anarchism in our paper in the late 1990s, I spoke to how this vision of a supposedly new society would in fact and inevitably lead back to the old capitalist imperialist society and world relations. So here I'll only briefly review some essential aspects of why and how this is so. If you try to have this kind of autonomy for, say, individual enterprises that are controlled by those who work them, first of all, if you think back to what Lenin talked about in terms of the relations of production, even within that factory, if you think, for example, about the, even if you have common ownership, that only deals in a formalistic way, in fact, with one aspect of the relation to production. Even though it's essential, it's not the whole of it. You still have within that a division of labor. The second part of the relations of production that Lenin talked about, which is going to be unequal. There are functions that you can't simply abolish that have to do with planning, managing, and carrying out production. So you're going to have, and if you insist on leveling down the wages of everybody to an equal amount in this autonomous cooperative framework, you still are going, haven't dealt with the fact that you have unequal tasks that people are doing, if you will, unequal functions that they're performing, unequal roles in the division of labor. And that difference will assert itself and will find spokespeople who will argue for that to be expressed in differences in wages and other benefits. Second of all, even leaving that aside, if you're still bound up in a system of commodity production, how are you going to exchange the things that are made? For example, let's say that you are making machinery to make other products. If you don't make machinery to make other products, your economy grinds to a halt. Well, you can't eat machinery. So you're going to have to engage in some form of exchange for that machinery with other units of this economy, also supposedly autonomous, in order to get things to wear and things to eat and shelter and so on. What is going to be the basis of that exchange? On what basis are you going to carry it out? If you're still within the confines of a commodity system, then some businesses or autonomous units are going to do better than others in these commodity relations and are going to start eating up the others, and you're going to get the reassertion of the kind of polarization that you're supposedly working to overcome. If you prevent that, you know, first of all, in order to prevent that, you'd have to have a state. You'd have to have a means of the government setting policy to say that can't happen, and whatever happens, we have to redistribute things to level it out. But then you'd have to have a state to enforce that, because the people who were taking, you know, who were getting the advantage and gaining in that would not all agree to that. You've gone a long way from transforming all the thinking of the people. And these spontaneous tendencies that I produced a better product, so I ought to get more, are going to assert themselves. So you're going to have a state. Well, what do you know? You wanted to have no state, but you have to have a state. Plus your state's going to be acting in an antagonistic way towards some of the members of these autonomous units. So you're going to get class antagonisms. Furthermore, you're still existing in a network of international relations and internationalized production. It's very rare, if not literally impossible, for any society to produce everything that it needs to keep developing. So you're going to have some form of international exchanges. Well, the rest of the world is not all going to be uniformly setting up these autonomous self-determined units that you're trying to implement. So what basis are they going to accept trade with you? Commodity relations. And so then those commodity relations that exist in terms of the international dimension and your trade with them are going to assert themselves and influence what you're seeking to do within your own economy with these autonomous and supposedly cooperating units. So you're not only going to get the polarization within each unit and between units, but it's going to be accentuated by and reinforced by and interacting with polarization caused by your interaction with the international dimension of economics. And pretty soon you're going to get a class of people that's going to arise that's going to say, this shit doesn't work, and let's go back to the old way of doing it. And then if you're an imperialist country, the old way of doing it is going to be back to exploiting people all over the world in the ways that we're all too familiar with. So this idea of attempting to transform society without the central role of a socialist state representing the outlook and interests of the proletariat is completely utopian and will lead to disaster, in fact. This goes along with Mao's statement that had the Paris Commune continued, it would have become a bourgeois republic instead of a socialist republic. And if you're an imperialist country, it means you'll be imperializing those relations. You'll be reasserting imperialist domination and exploitation on an international scale, or you'll go under and become dominated and exploited by another imperialist power and other imperialist units of capital and other imperialist states. Now, one of the most important historical illustrations of this, one of the most important historical contexts in which the kinds of anarchists and related tendencies that I have been discussing were in fact a significant phenomenon, was the Spanish Civil War in the 1930s. In that Spanish Civil War, the Republican forces, the forces of the Republican government, which consisted of anarchists, socialists of various kinds, and the Communist Party of Spain, along with more open and classical bourgeois Democrats. These Republican forces were ultimately defeated and decimated by the fascists, headed by Franco and backed by Italy and Germany. And this led to a whole period of brutal fascist rule in Spain under Franco, lasting for a number of decades. In an article in the Old Revolution magazine, it is pointed out that the anarchist and anarcho-syndicalist doctrine, which put forward things like the trade unions or syndicates and the free municipality as the nuclei of the new society, that this is at bottom conservative, closer to the outlook and interests of the petty bourgeoisie than of the proletariat. It sees no need for the proletariat to seize power and establish the dictatorship of the proletariat because it really sees no need to transform society. Or if it does see a need, it is incapable of doing it for the reasons that I've spoken to. And the article goes on, instead of doing away with classes and the material and ideological basis for class differences in order to liberate all mankind, the anarcho-syndicalists advocated a liberation factory by factory and farm by farm whose workers and peasants would, quote-unquote, liberate themselves by cooperatively going into business for themselves. It's a very important point this article is making. Now, it is a real irony that the Spanish Civil War remains one of the main historical experiences marshaled by anarchists and other ultimately bourgeois democratic radicals and liberals in their bitter denunciations and indictments of communism and the historical experience of the communist movement and socialist countries. But without going into this, attempting to go into an examination of this whole historical experience, it can and should be emphasized that the fact is that this critique, coming from these anarchists and various radical bourgeois Democrats and so on, flowing from the overall incorrect ideological and political views of such forces, is essentially wrong-headed and misidentifies the nature and basis of what were, in fact, grievously wrong policies and actions by the Communist Party of Spain during that civil war, under the influence and leadership of the Soviet Union and the Communist International at that time, or the Comintern for short. As pointed out and analyzed in some depth in the article on the Spanish Civil War in that old Revolution magazine, the essential and, in fact, devastating error of the Spanish communists lay not in their tendencies to bureaucracy and bureaucratization and centralism. For example, their insistence on centralizing the anti-fascist armed forces over the objections and resistance of many anarchists and others was in itself, and taken by itself, very correct and very necessary. But rather, the essential problem was that the Spanish communists increasingly insisted on subordinating, and in fact actively worked to subordinate, the struggle in Spain to the policy of the Soviet Union and of the Comintern, a policy of seeking an alliance with the so-called democratic imperialist governments of England, France, and the U.S. against the fascist imperialist states, above all Germany. The result was that the struggle in Spain became more and more subordinated to the dictates of those quote-unquote democratic imperialist states. And this was a major factor leading to the fighting of the Spanish Civil War on the Republican side on more and more bourgeois terms, which in turn contributed to its ultimate and devastating defeat. And in this connection, it's worth noting that this issue of Revolution magazine, issue number 49, June 1981, also includes other articles of not only historical interest, but very real present-day relevance. In particular, my outline of views on the historical experience of the international communist movement and the lessons for today, which was accompanied by an addendum on the character of World War II, and which preceded and laid much of the basis and groundwork for Conquer the World. What all this actually demonstrates, when approached with a truly and fully scientific standpoint and method, is the great and fundamental need for the interests and outlook of the proletariat in the broadest and most sweeping and radical sense to be in the forefront. It underlines once again the need for an organized vanguard based precisely on communism, and more specifically, a communism that is not diluted, by revisionism, pragmatism, and bourgeois realpolitik, but a communism that is capable of leading the struggle to actually overthrow the truly bloodthirsty guardians of the old order, as they were shown to be in extreme terms in the Spanish Civil War and elsewhere throughout history. To bring into being a radically new and different society in which a radically new and different kind of state, the dictatorship of the proletariat, plays the central and decisive role economically, politically, and in an all-around way, and at the same time increasingly involves the masses of people in running and transforming all of society and in wrangling over how to do that. And in so doing, continuing to advance toward the eventual abolition of class distinctions altogether and all exploitative and oppressive relations and ways of thinking bound up with class divisions. And with that, with the achievement of that, the abolition of the state itself, as this revolution triumphs ultimately, not just in one or another country, but throughout the world. With anarchism and anarcho-syndicalism and similar trends, there is yet again a parallel with, or another expression of, the relation between those old friends of ours, the shopkeeper and the democratic intellectual, that Marx spoke of in the 18th Brumaire of Louis Bonaparte. What Marx said there, once more, was that in their everyday life and even their ways of looking at things, the democratic intellectual and the shopkeeper may be as far apart as heaven and earth. Yet, the essential point is that in their thinking, in their way of conceiving how society is and also ought to be, the democratic intellectuals do not get beyond the bounds in that thinking that the shopkeeper does not get beyond in everyday practical life. Here again, we have to understand dialectical as opposed to reductionist materialism. a number of, I don't know, maybe it's years ago now, but a while ago, I used Amy Goodman as an example of this. I talked about how, you know, despite many positive qualities and important contributions she makes, even as indicated by the title of her show, she can't get beyond the framework which the shopkeeper can't get beyond an everyday practical life. In other words, she's still within the narrow confines of bourgeois rights. She still sees things in terms of democracy in a classless way, which in reality translates into democracy as the dictatorship of the bourgeoisie. She can't see beyond a society based on commodity production and exchange. And I heard a report somewhere, some people, you know, even in our party were discussing this example I gave, and someone said, well, Amy Goodman, she's just a shopkeeper. No, you missed the whole point. It reminds me of like when Bob Dylan was giving a concert years ago, and he used to wear this jacket, kind of a jean jacket. And he came out to perform at one show, and many, many people in the audience were wearing these jean jackets. And he looked at them and he said, you missed the whole point. So when I hear this person saying, Amy Goodman, she's just a shopkeeper, that came to my mind. You missed the whole point. You missed the heaven and earth point. The point is not that Amy Goodman is a shopkeeper, or even that her outlook is exactly that of a shopkeeper. It is heaven and earth from that. She has a very broad view of many, many questions. She does not approach life the way a shopkeeper does. The point, though, drawing from Marx, is that in the final analysis, her view of how society ought to be and the idea of sort of a classless democracy remains rooted within the confines of what? Of those bourgeois production relations which establish the foundation for what kind of superstructure there is and can be. And until you make a leap beyond that in your thinking, until you see that you have to move through one system of class rule through to a radically different form of class rule to get to where there are no longer classes, and there will therefore no longer be a need for or the existence of a state, and there will also no longer be a need for or the existence of formal structures and institutions that are there to prevent one part of society from oppressing another. You move beyond all that and you get to a different form of governmental institutions, processes, and structures which reflect the fact that there is not only are there no longer any antagonistic social relations, but there's no longer any basis for those antagonistic social relations. This is another way of saying getting beyond the narrow horizon of bourgeois right, advancing to the achievement of the four alls and leading to the abolition of any kind of state with the abolition of those four alls, the transformation of those four alls, and therefore to the abolition also of democracy as a form in which there is a need in one way or another for formal structures and institutions to protect the rights of people and prevent one part of society from denying rights to others and oppressing others. It's the leap beyond the need for all that that's involved in achieving the four alls. So it's not a perfection of democracy, let alone a perfection of bourgeois democracy that we're aiming for, but a leap beyond the whole question of the state on the one hand and the need for democratic structures and institutions and processes to protect people's rights and prevent oppression on the other hand and at the same time. And this is what the shopkeeper in daily life is engaged in, a form of bourgeois right, in a form of exchanging commodities according to their value, which is all bound up with and rooted in a system of exploitation which depends upon a particular form of commodity exchange. The driving force of capitalist accumulation and the defining element fundamentally of capitalist society as a whole is a peculiar and particular kind of commodity exchange, namely the sale of labor power. And in that exchange, in which the worker gets a wage equal to and equivalent to the amount of things that are necessary for his or her reproduction and maintenance in that condition of exploitation, through that exchange and in the employment of that labor power on the basis of that exchange, surplus value or profit is produced through the exploitation of the working class, through the use of its labor power by the capitalist to accumulate wealth through competitive contention among capitalists, not only in one country but throughout the world. That is the essential commodity exchange which provides the basis on which capitalism moves forward, is driven forward, and accumulates, and on which all of the superstructure of capitalist society develops and which it reinforces in the dialectical sense of which I've been speaking of, and not in a mechanical materialist sense. So if your demand is for democracy now, you're either trying to pretend that there can be some kind of democracy that doesn't reflect the actual class relations and commodity exchanges that are characteristic of and define capitalism, or you're acting as if you could abolish all those things simply by creating equality among people economically and politically all at once without undergoing the transformation of those four alls. At best, it's utopianism, and in reality, it just devolves down to, it ends up being transformed back into accepting the confines of bourgeois democracy, which means bourgeois dictatorship, which means you're trapped within the narrow confines and have not leapt beyond the narrow horizon of bourgeois right. So an Amy Goodman thinks in very different terms in daily life and acts in relation to events very differently than most shopkeepers. But in the end, she does not get beyond the terms in her thinking that the shopkeeper does not get beyond in everyday life. Her thinking, in other words, does not leap beyond the bounds of commodity production and exchange and the four alls, just as the shopkeeper in everyday life is engaged in the practical humdrum business of the exchange of commodities. That was Marx's very profound and dialectical materialist explanation or illustration of one key element of the relation between the base and the superstructure. That's the end of the first section of this talk.